Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Lopez de Victoria. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Nathan Bankson, and I, along with Colonel Christopher O'Brien, represent the appellant, Sergeant Eric Lopez de Victoria. This court does have statutory jurisdiction to hear this case, and you can find that authority by following this court's decision in United States versus Tucker. That decision is bolstered by this court's opinion in United States versus Duwalt, and specifically the principles of stare decisis and executive acquiescence. Once this court determines it does have jurisdiction, it can then turn to the proper application of Article 43, which is a prospective application. This court can look to United States Supreme Court precedent dating back to 1938 in Hassett v. Wells, which says, absent clear congressional intent to the contrary, statutes are to be applied prospectively. I'll first discuss the jurisdictional issue. In one page, United States versus Tucker synthesized the analysis that this court can follow to find jurisdiction. The first hurdle it had was overcoming Article 67C and that claim language. In so doing, it looked to the All Writs Act and specifically United States versus Redding and Caprio. It looked to those cases because they dealt with situations where there was no commuting authority action and there was no review on that action by the service court. There was review by a service court. It then said, if we can do that with writs, then we should certainly be able to do that with an interlocutory appeal under Article 62. They are both sort of extraordinary in that situation, but it looked to Article 67 and didn't read it quite consistently with the All Writs Act in the legislative history. Now, that legislative history, which does say that any case may be reviewed by this court after an Article 62 appeal, is not dispositive. But when we look at RCN 908C3, we can see that the executive branch, which contemporaneously wrote 908C3 during the time of the Military Justice Act of 1983, illuminated, if you will, as Tucker says, the congressional intent of Article 62.
I do have a question about that, counsel, which is how can legislative intent be illuminated by executive rulemaking?
Because the drafters, as said in Tucker, were the same for the executive branch as they were for Congress. And we can, I guess, presume that they were speaking with each other when they were saying, how is a practitioner supposed to act upon Article 62? What's the government supposed to do if they have an unfavorable ruling on a 62? So we can look at how the executive interpreted Article 62 and its interplay with Article 67, and couple that with the decisions of this court in Redding and Caprio, and we can a totality of the circumstances argument there to see how that legislative intent transferred over into an RCM.
Is there any authority that you could find that the drafters of one piece of legislation might have been the drafters of rules and therefore could enlighten us on intent?
United States versus Tucker is the only case that says that they were the same, Your Honor, and that's what we've been relying on for the last 22 years and how to read Article 62 and Article 67C in harmony. So what we've got,
counsel, with respect to that particular part of Tucker, was the court in Tucker saying that they were looking to the 908C3 and the legislative history to find meaning in the statute, or were they looking at it to confirm the meaning that they had already found in the case of Redding?
Your Honor, I think they looked at it to confirm. They went immediately from the government's argument, which is, hey, Article 67C prohibits the government from bringing a case up to this court. Then they said, okay, well, how do we read 67C? Well, we read it the same way as we did with the All Writs Act and Redding and Caprio, where we got to jump ahead of the process and look at these cases. And then they said, no, that's great. Now let's look at the legislative history to make sure we're not off base. This court then looked at that and saw what Senator Jackson said when he proposed the Article 62 in the Military Justice Act of 1983. He said, okay, that makes sense. Now, are we tracking here all the way? Let's look at the RCM. It was made contemporaneously. This court said, hey, that's illuminating. That makes sense. This is how all three branches of government are now interpreting it. So given the Congress's action in the Military Justice Act of 1983, the RCM, previous case law on writs, and now we have this court's decision. We have all three branches of government working together.
So what you're saying is that the RCM is a contemporary executive elucidation of the statute.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. So with that, then we've got Tucker. 22 years later, here we find ourselves, and we can look at United States versus Tuala, where this court said executive acquiescence should be given considerable weight when determining if the law or this court's decision is unworkable. So couple that with stare decisis, one of the principles outlined in then-Chief Judge Crawford's concurrence was, is it unworkable or badly reasoned?
Well, I have a couple of questions about what I think your argument rests on, which is, one, you seem to be making an argument that we have jurisdiction based on a constellation of factors. Is that your argument?
I think that this court's interpretation of all of the factors does give this court jurisdiction, and its reading of Article 67C with Article 67C.
Okay, well, two questions about that. First, and I'll give you the two questions, then you can answer them however you would like to, which is, first of all, how does that constellation of factors approach square with the requirement that an Article I court is a court of limited jurisdiction and that our statutory grant has to be explicit? And secondly, how does it square with the, I think, overwhelming historical fact that there is no interlocutory appeals as a general matter in criminal cases by defendants?
That's the first part, Your Honor. When we look at the constellation, when we look at what Tucker did, we can I'm not sure how to answer that, Your Honor. I think what we have to do is go back to United States versus Tucker. We have to look at how it looked at Article 67, and while it is an interlocutory appeal.
I would now go back to Tucker.
Okay.
Usually when people bring up totality of circumstances in a war powers context or something, you start to wonder whether they have a basic argument or not. Right? Either you argue self-defense or you argue UN Security Council authorization, but when they start dancing around with totality, you start to wonder what's going on. Is your argument predicated on the totality of circumstances, or are you just throwing everything up here and your argument starts with the plain text and the structure of the code?
Your Honor, I think Article 67...
I want to make sure you're not getting maneuvered by the questioning because you're responding to the judges, but say, my argument is one, two, three. What is your argument?
My argument is one. Article 67C cannot be read as strictly as it is read. It can be read in harmony with Article 62, and by looking at the legislative history of Article 62, we see that Senator Jepson and that adoption of 62 says, any case we did the
What Senator Jepson had to do with a clean reading of this thing?
Is the statute ambiguous?
It is, Your Honor. When you read Article 67C...
No, is 62 ambiguous?
It is not, Your Honor.
Well, then why do we need to look at legislative history?
Because when you read 62 with 67A, 2, and 3, which say all cases reviewed by the service court may be or shall be reviewed by this court.
Counsel, didn't we reject that argument in the United States against Leak? That is, that Article 67C has jurisdictional significance only 2 years ago?
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that case.
Well, it's cited in one of the briefs here, and my recollection is in United States against League, the very argument that's being discussed today was discussed in League. That in League, the issue that was specified by the court was, did this court lack jurisdiction over a case in which the lower court's decision did not meet all the indicia of Article 67C, and we expressly rejected that argument in League.
All right, Your Honor, I do not know the facts of that case, so I do not know if it's distinguishable or not. If it is cited in my brief, I apologize for not having the facts.
It's not cited in your briefs. It's cited in one of the briefs on the issue.
I did not think it was cited in this brief, Your Honor.
Just to be clear, is your argument that your appeal that we have jurisdiction because of Article 62, because of Article 67, or both?
62 provides this court's jurisdiction is rested on Article 67.
Okay, would you, as a first proposition, would you agree that Article 62 applies by its clear and unambiguous terms to government appeals?
It applies to government appeals.
And would you agree that it says nothing about appeals by criminal defendants?
It does not.
Okay, so Article 62 has nothing to do with whether you have a right to appeal.
That's correct, Your Honor. It deals with government appeals solely.
So your appeal is not an Article 62 appeal?
No, it is a response to the government's action, Your Honor, which was the Article 62 appeal.
Counsel, as I understood your argument that you originally made, and maybe it's been changed through the course of questioning, you cited to the first statement made by the court in Tucker. It appears that under the plain language of Article 67B3, which is now A3, a petition for review may be filed in the court. And then the rest of the discussion in Tucker was looking at the legislative history, the RCM, et cetera, to determine whether that was an accurate reading.
Yes, Your Honor.
So my question is, are you relying on the plain language of Article 67A3 as your primary source of authority, or are you looking at the legislative history and the RCM as your primary source of authority?
Your Honor, I am relying on the plain language of Article 67A3. However, we have Article 67C to deal with at the same time. So the way I frame my argument is, yes, all cases, certainly doesn't mean all cases. That is the plain language of Article 67A2 and 3. So, all cases.
So how do you, and I understand, I think your argument about 67A3 and 67C, how, in light of the second question I asked you, which is a historical fact that interlocutory appeals by criminal defendants are generally not permitted, would you agree that that's the case?
Yes, and we do have writs, Your Honor, and that is...
Well, this is not a writ. This is a straight appeal.
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay, so if you could square the historical fact and explain how, in light of that fact, we are to take 67A and 67C to give us jurisdiction over an interlocutory appeal by a criminal defendant.
Yes, the same way Redding and Caprio talked about how the government can petition as opposed to certify a question by the TJ for a writ. It's the same analysis that I think it's Redding followed by saying, hey, look, if the language of 67A2 and 3 are identical, then we should provide them a similar course of action. While there is no interlocutory appeal right for the criminal defendant, we do have this response that we now must make. The government has taken a win for the appellant, turned it into a loss at the service court, and now we're reacting to that. Is there another means for doing that? Yes, we could go back down to the service court, submit the case on its merits, and we'll be right back here. We are now finding ourselves in this process, which is unauthorized by...
Is this an argument of judicial economy?
Well, I think that cuts both ways, but if we hear this case now, determine that it does have jurisdiction, this case may not come here again. If we can settle it at this level, the community authority may not have to act, which would lend to judicial economy with that respect. Now, is it possible that it goes back down and comes back up on a different issue? Yes, that's possible, but that's going to be fact determinative for the case, and I think if this court can hear it now, then it does make judicial sense because it avoids the service court having another bite, the community authority possibly having another bite. You can settle this law right now.
Are you familiar with the United States Supreme Court cases of Kopeldick versus the United States or Abney versus the United States?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're not familiar with the discussion about finality and the disfavored nature of interlocutory appeals?
No, Your Honor, but in that vein, we do allow writs practice. In this court, and that is not in the name of the court martial, that 1651 allows writs practice for all courts empowered by the Constitution. We do allow that practice. That is not finality either, Your Honor. So insofar as Tucker relies on writs to get to find jurisdiction here and reading the plain language of Article 67A, then B, I think we can overcome that, Your Honor. I think it is probably before this court, and this court's case law has agreed with that without change.
Is there a military necessity that requires an upset to the rule in every other federal court that there's no interlocutory criminal appeals by criminal defendants as a general matter?
Is there a reason? No.
Is there a particular military necessity for a change to the general rule in every other federal court in the country?
No, there's not, Your Honor, unless this court agrees that because of the military nature that we've got, the service court is military judges. This is the first civilian oversight we have of a situation like this. So it may be necessary, if that's agreeable, it may be necessary for this court to hear that, to give that civilian oversight. Now, that may not square directly with Clinton v. Goldsmith's principles with the Writs Act, but I think we can distinguish that also. So I think there may be military necessity here. I'm just not sure if it's strong enough, but if that's what it takes to get this jurisdiction, then maybe that's the one we find.
Counsel, I'm not clear on what the military necessity argument is here with respect to the relationship to distinguishing the practice here from the practice in other federal courts. Are you arguing that the practice is different here from practice in other federal courts in terms of the ability to appeal an interlocutory matter that is otherwise subject to appeal once it gets to the first level?
The client's different, Your Honor. That's the difference, is that the client is part of the military institution, whereas in the civilian side, we don't have that issue. We don't have unlawful command influence.
Are you suggesting that a civilian defendant could not appeal an adverse decision under the government appeal statute from a federal Article III circuit? What's the authority for that?
3731 grant, which is what Article 62 is mirrored after, does grant jurisdiction for the governor, does grant jurisdiction in a circuit court for the government to appeal.
And are you aware of any authority for the proposition that the defense can't appeal an adverse ruling from the circuit court?
1254 should grant jurisdiction in the Supreme Court by a petition of certiorari.
Thanks.
So, and what Tucker didn't do, actually what the legislative history in 62 didn't do is say, we've got 3731, that's what we want 62 to mirror, insofar as practical, as the language Senator Jepson puts out. It doesn't get to 1254. It does say the government should have the same rights here as it does in the federal practice, so it's trying to create parity there. But it doesn't say then, hey, 1254 is what allows that appeal to get to the Supreme Court. And so here we have, in the federal practice, we've got the first review by the district court, by the appellate court.
And as I understand the government's argument in this case, is that if the government loses at the Court of Criminal Appeals, it can't appeal to our court. Is that the posture we're in today?
Yes. Well, we're in the posture of if Tucker is overturned, that's absolutely correct. They do not have a course of action under Article 62. The analysis of Tucker is incorrect. So, and if they're reading Article 67, is incorrect. That would be the impalpable result, is that the government would then lose. That is where we find ourselves. The consequence for us is we go back down and try it again. The client stays in jail a little longer. For the government, they are done. So, and that is different than the federal practice, where they do have that petition for cert to the Supreme Court. There is another review after our service court equivalent in the district. So,
I have some questions on the statute of limitations, but I don't want to cut off any further discussion on the jurisdictional issue. In view of Stogner, what would be the purpose served by allowing statute of limitations in this case, or not allowing the statute of limitations in this case to apply to your client?
Can you say that in view of Stogner?
In view of Stogner. In other words, the idea in Stogner that extending within the period in which a person is still subject to the statute of limitations is not unconstitutional. What would be the purpose served by adopting a contrary posture here with respect to this statute? I understand your legislative argument in terms of looking at what happened in 1986 and suggesting the same should apply now. So it's not an interpretive question. It's a question of, well, it is an interpretive question, but it's not looking at that particular aspect of interpretation. It's looking at the underlying policy that you suggested earlier on perspective only. What aspect of perspective only is served by applying that to a statute of limitations when the person is still subject to the statute of limitations at the time the legislation is enacted?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, Stogner does say that the ex post facto clause doesn't have to run with statutes that have retroactive language. The difference here is the language in this statute does not have retroactive language. It does not say what 3283 says. It does not say what Senator Nelson...
I try the question a different way. I think what the Chief Judge is asking you is, what are the legal policy arguments, putting aside whether the plain text leads you one place or the other? What are the legal policy arguments for applying a statute of limitations retroactively or not? 2C identifies some of the legal policy reasons both ways. This is your chance to highlight those legal policy reasons.
Okay, well...
Is that a fair characterization of your question?
Much, much better, thank you.
Well, I think the law at the close of the time of the crime is the one that has timeless and universal appeal, if we're going to go to 2C. And when we're stuck with picking an interpretation that has retroactive application here, which would ensnare my client and about 5 years of other people, exactly 5 years of other people, or looking prospectively as the date that the decision...
That's preamble. Answer the question, please.
Yes. We're going to require Congress to speak clearly as to its intent before we apply retroactively.
Right, but what are the legal policy reasons that may inform that judgment if, for example, you are a legislator?
The policy reasons?
Like 2C, for example, I'm going to give you one of them because I don't want to feed you the answer.
Okay.
It's your answer, not ours. One answer would be one reason is law enforcement officials may more promptly investigate allegations of wrongdoing.
All right. So
that's a legal policy reason. That doesn't tell you whether Congress did something or didn't do something, but it might tell you why they did it.
Okay, so if that's one, that the police should be more vigilant in their investigations, another one would be that the evidence is stale, that the witnesses may not be there, that we're putting a certain finite time on the government's ability to act with respect to a crime. Those would be the legal policy reasons. I don't even think we need to get there, Ron, when we look at how the statute's written. I think those may support reading the statute in a particular way, but the fact of the matter is this statute does not read the same as 3283. It does not have retroactive application.
Counsel, that wasn't my question. I don't think it was Judge Baker's amplification of my question. That is, I understand the arguments, I hope I do, that you're making for purposes of statutory interpretation. But the separate question here is one in which making the determination of statutory interpretation, are we informed by an underlying policy of statute should be prospective only, or that statutes of limitation are in a different category? And if they're in a different category, should they not be in a different category? Because not all statutes are viewed in the criminal law area are viewed as prospective only. So-called procedural statutes routinely are not.
I don't think that there should be a distinction here that would allow us to have retroactive application. 2C is the case that would say that statute of limitation statutes should be viewed prospectively. So as far as we have Supreme Court precedent saying this is how we're going to look at the statute of limitations, procedural, substantive, this is what we're going to do with it. Why are we doing that? Because the police should act faster. Maybe that's one policy reason. Because the evidence may have gone stale, that may be another reason. Because the government is being limited in how it can act with respect to people. Now, we don't have an ex post facto clause violation here, but that is another policy reason. We should not be reviving something that's already dead. Again, that's not the case here, but that's another policy reason for why we look at a statute to be prospective. And I do think that reading the statute does help us figure that out. Substantive procedural, I think it may be a red herring if we look at 2C as a binding Supreme Court precedent. Looking at...
Was it binding on this point?
Taking on?
Is it binding on this point?
It is binding.
Why is it binding on the point of whether the general presumption is that a statute of limitations where Congress is otherwise quiet on intent shall apply prospectively rather than retrospectively?
Why is it binding? Well, we have Scrivener, in fact, does say, hey, if you want a statute to apply retroactively, look at 3293. If you want to legislate for it, you can write it just like this one. Scrivener says there's no ex post facto clause violation, but that's how we do it. We also have...
Right, those cases point out a better way to do it, or a clearer way to do it. But why does 2C compel the result that the presumption, period, is prospective only? Can you identify the language, please, if you would? Where is that
It says when a choice has to be made between two readings of what Congress has made a crime, is appropriate before choosing the harsher, to require that Congress should have spoken in language that is clear and definite. And again, they go on to say every statute of limitations, of course, may permit a rogue to escape. We understand that. We understand that when we put a timeline on activity, what we can prosecute, that there is a limit. And without that language, we shouldn't be going back in time, particularly when there's only one statute of limitations in the UCMJ, and we knew exactly what we wanted it to do. One senator decided that he wanted it to mirror 3283. So that was on February 6, 2003. In November 24, 2003, Congress spoke.
What, if anything, do you think the CCA got wrong in its statutory interpretation?
Your Honor, I think that they looked to a state Supreme Court case which actually overruled one of its prior precedents, Paradise.
Did they characterize what Congress did correctly?
They characterized what Congress did correctly.
Are you repeating the question? What did Congress do in this statute? Look at page 8 of the CCA opinion. What do they say about what Congress did?
Well, I think, and before I get there, but Congress...
What did Congress do in this statute?
It wanted to mirror 3283. It extended the statute of limitations.
Well, did Congress incorporate 3283, which is what Senator Nelson wanted to do?
Yes.
They incorporated it by reference?
It says Section 3283 of Title 18 relating to...
No, I'm not talking about Nelson's bill. I'm talking about the Amendment 43.
It's 25 years, Your Honor. So insofar as they made it longer than it was, which was 5 years, they did incorporate 3283. But they stopped at that. They extended it longer. They did not extend it back in time. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Go ahead.
So we do have differences of language. We do have a situation which is different than what the service court says happened. And if we want to take an analogous analysis, we look at Richardson and how it dealt with Toosey's decision. Toosey was decided.
Counsel, if you'd want to continue in this vein, I'd suggest you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal. I appreciate that you were answering the questions from the judges, but your time has now expired.
Right.
If you're in the midst of a thought and you want to complete it briefly, please do so.
Your Honor, this court does have jurisdiction, according to the plain language of Article 67.
I didn't suggest there was an opportunity for you to restate your argument.
Okay. This court should find that it has jurisdiction. Uphold Tucker. It should then find that Article 43 applies prospectively, not retroactively. And we'd ask that you overturn ACCA's decision, which reinstated Charge 1, Specs 1, 2, and 4.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
May it please the Court. I'm Captain James P. Leary, and I, along with Colonel John Miller, represent the United States government. A plain language reading of Article 67 requires this Court to conclude that it does not have jurisdiction to hear this claim. However, should the Court determine that it does have jurisdiction, the decision of the Army Court of Criminal Appeals should be affirmed, and the appellant's conviction for sexually molesting his 6-year-old daughter should be upheld. This Court does not have jurisdiction to hear this claim under Article 67, UCMJ. Because this is an Article 1 court, it is limited by the statutory jurisdiction given to it by Congress. Article 67 limits this court to act only with respect to findings and sentence as approved by the convening authority and is affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the Court of Appeals. This court is limited by the statutory jurisdiction, and this court in Tucker went beyond that statutory jurisdiction and therefore should be overruled. When considering whether or not to overrule a case, this court has determined that it must determine whether or not the case before it was unworkable or badly reasoned. Tucker is both unworkable and badly reasoned.
It's unworkable. What caused the government to reach this conclusion now as opposed to the previous cases? Did it become unworkable yesterday?
No, Your Honor, it did not become unworkable yesterday. However, the government, in determining whether and looking at whether or not it was unworkable or not, had to see what the statutory jurisdiction is. When a case goes beyond when a court goes beyond its statutory jurisdiction in a case, that therefore becomes unworkable.
Well, unworkable and non-jurisdictional are two different things. Unworkable goes to practicality, and jurisdiction goes to ability to decide.
Yes, Your Honor, and I understand that. Under that vein, clearly this court has been able to work a system where something can come up before the court. However, The government's position is that by going beyond its statutory jurisdiction, that this case is unworkable.
If we accept your proposition, could we review this kind of thing on a writ?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, it's axiomatic that the Writs Act doesn't grant jurisdiction. And we don't have jurisdiction, then how can we use a writ?
Well, it's the government's contention that the All Writs Act and Article 67 are two different statutory frameworks that this court can review.
Article 67 is jurisdictional, the Writs Act is not. So how do we get jurisdiction to grant a writ if we don't have jurisdiction in the first place? Which is your position?
Well, Your Honor, we read the All Writs Act as giving this court jurisdiction.
Well, Clinton versus Goldsmith.
No, it's an aid to our jurisdiction. You have to have pre-existing jurisdiction.
I understand. I apologize, Your Honor. I didn't understand the question. You're correct, Your Honor, in that in order for this court to act on a writ, it must be an aid of its jurisdiction. However, when we look at a case such as, for this as an example, this we would have an aid of jurisdiction because it would be able to come before this court. Now, Clinton versus Goldsmith, when deciding that this court didn't have jurisdiction in that particular case, was talking about something where the court, and it specifically says, could not, did not, and could not have had jurisdiction. That is, this court does not have the ability to review an administrative separation. Whereas in this case, it would be able to come before the court under Article, if it goes back to the lower court, under Article 66. So therefore, it would be in aid of its jurisdiction.
So are you talking about, for example, potential jurisdiction if it was an appellant and frustration of potential jurisdiction if it was a government?
Yes, Your Honor.
So your plain meaning interpretation of Article 67C, which we rejected in Leak, but if we're going to overrule Leak and now take a different look at Article 67C, in Article 67C, it refers to any case. Now, if we take a plain meaning, why isn't an extraordinary writ any case? If we apply Article 67C the way you want to read it, how can we ever get extraordinary writ before this court? Is your view that any doesn't mean any and case doesn't mean case?
No, Your Honor, that is not our position. In fact, when we were looking at Article 67, it is talking about, it is looking back to 66. Cases which have a which are coming to court under Article 66, and that our interpretation is that Article 67 governs Article 66 claims, and that it does not deal at all with writs.
Well, that's very interesting because in your brief you suggest that Congress didn't know what it was doing, or the people who wrote the legislative history, the members of Congress who issued that report, didn't know what they were doing because they should have relied on Best instead of Redding. But my recollection is that in Redding, our court had before it two motions from before it. One was a motion from the government to appeal the extraordinary writ, to bring extraordinary writ before this court. And the second was a straightforward certification from the Judge Advocate General under Article 67, the provision that's now Article 67A. And our court specifically decided that it would not treat the case before it as an extraordinary writ and specifically relied on Article 67A. Now, doesn't that show that at least in the time of Redding, issued on the eve of the drafting of Article 62, that this court believed that it had jurisdiction under Article 67A to review a case, even though it met none of the criteria of Article 67C? No findings, no sentence, no convening authority action. We're going to have to overrule Redding? Was Redding wrongly decided?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so we're going to have to overrule Leak. We're going to have to overrule Tucker. We're going to have to overrule Boudreau, which rejected the language in Best. We're going to have to overrule Redding. Of course, Redding's a case that you all think can give you somehow get the court up here on extraordinary writ. How many other cases are we going to have to overrule to give the result that the government wants, which is to deprive the Judge Advocate General of the ability to certify a case to us?
Your Honor, I couldn't name all the cases which I could name off the top of my head that this Court would have to review in order to enforce a plain language reading of Article 67.
So we're going to be pretty busy overruling our past precedents here, most of which were in favor of the government.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, I have a question along those same lines. If the Court, in fact, does not have jurisdiction to hear this issue or this case now, would it be reasonable to rely on stare decisis to continue to hear cases that we don't have power to hear?
No, Your Honor.
That's not a prudential decision, is it?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, when we look at what gives jurisdiction to this Court, what's going to go back to the fact that this is an Article I Court? It is limited by the jurisdiction given to it by Congress. And as such, it is limited by Article 67C, which I'm going to refer back to in saying that this Court may act only with respect to the findings and sentences approved by the convening authority and is affirmed or set aside as incorrect in law by the Court of Appeals.
So if that's the case, if that's what Article 67C means, and I wasn't being facetious in referring to all those cases we have to overrule, do we then have to vacate all the decisions in those cases and give all the individuals the opportunity to contest their convictions? Because if we didn't have jurisdiction to issue those rulings in those cases, would they not be a nullity?
Your Honor, I'd have to come up with a supplemental brief to that question.
I'm not asking for a supplemental brief. I'm just asking for is that the import of where the government's position would take us in this case? That is, we've got, as you know, numerous cases in which the Court has ruled in favor of the government using Article 67A jurisdiction over interlocutory matters. And if Redding is incorrectly decided, and Leak is incorrectly decided, and Tucker is incorrectly decided, and Boudreau is incorrectly decided, it's not just those cases, it's everybody who's all the cases that have relied on them that are not nullities.
Once again, Your Honor, there would certainly be a lot of work for this Court to do.
To your statement, your response to the question then is, if this Court did not have jurisdiction, then those cases are nullities. Is that not correct?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to
that. Why don't you consult your second chair? That seems to be a fundamental question that's black-letter law for which the government ought to have an answer.
The answer is yes, it would be a nullity. Those cases would be a nullity. However, looking back at some of the cases which were mentioned.
And I'm not asking you to speak for all those cases. I'm asking you to answer the black letter law question. Okay, because if you're a counsel, you'd want to actually look at the cases before you made a statement about them. Fair enough. But I'm asking the black letter law question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, can you...
In the black letter law question is, if this Court did not have jurisdiction when it decided a case, would not that case be a nullity?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your position on the legislative history of the 83 Act? Do you, as the Chief Judge characterized it, maintain that the Senate Armed Services Committee didn't know what it was doing when it wrote that?
Your Honor, I'm not making a judgment as to whether or not they knew what they were doing.
What I would say,
however, we would say that they went, to the Senate Armed Services Committee, and when they wrote...
When they wrote their report language.
Okay, in the report language?
Yeah.
No, I don't think that that's a... it's not that they didn't know what they were doing or didn't know the cases of Redding. I would say that when we only go to that language, however, when there is a question as to whether or not there is there's plain language. And in this particular case...
Is the statute ambiguous?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the statute here is not ambiguous.
The statute is not ambiguous, so the legislative history, so the contemporaneous construction by the people who drafted it is irrelevant.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Fair enough.
Counsel, I have a slightly different question, which is something that has puzzled me a bit about all of the briefs in this case, is the fact that no one seems to have talked about the issue of interlocutory appeals just as a prudential matter. So now jurisdictional matter, just as a prudential matter. And have you looked at that at all?
Your Honor, we've looked at that as a general matter. I couldn't name specific statutes. What I can say is that in general, the rule is that the government has the right to appeal an interlocutory appeal.
Because otherwise double jeopardy will attach and they'll never have an opportunity.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Do you know what the state of the law is with respect to criminal defendants' interlocutory appeals?
Once again, Your Honor, I couldn't name you specific statutes, but going back to the general overview of state and federal law is that the defendants do not have the opportunity to have an interlocutory appeal.
Are you familiar with how that would operate? The Chief Judge had a question before for appellant's counsel as to how that would operate if the government prevailed on a 3731 appeal in a circuit court of appeals and then the defendant wanted to appeal to the Supreme Court. Are you familiar with how that works or not? If you're not prepared to discuss it, that's fine.
I'm not prepared to discuss it at this moment, Your Honor.
I have a question on the statute of limitations, but does anyone want to pursue the jurisdiction further? I didn't want to cut you off if you had more you wanted to say on jurisdiction.
Your Honor.
Same question I asked for the counsel for the defense as amplified by my colleague, and that is, what is there in Stadner that tells us how we should interpret a statute of limitations when the statute of limitations on its face does not expressly address retroactivity or prospectivity?
I'm not sure exactly.
Is there anything in Stadner that tells us how we should interpret a statute of limitations when the statute of limitations on its face doesn't address retroactivity or prospectivity, a case that we have here? You're arguing for statutory interpretation here.
Stadner addresses a very specific statute. And so in so doing, most of the language which is read in that is talking about that statute. That statute was, in Stadner, was admittedly very specific what rules applied and did not apply.
So are we bound by any Supreme Court decision in our action on this case?
No, Your Honor.
Are we bound by any precedent of this court in our action on this case?
No, Your Honor.
So what is your best legal citation for us to look at as a source of authority as to how we should interpret this statute as to whether it will apply prospectively only or retrospectively only?
Your Honor, I would refer this court to the 2005 Eighth Circuit case in U.S. versus Jeffries. Would be what I would characterize as the best.
Can I take you back a step? Is it the government's position, as it was at the trial level, that with respect to the plain text of the amendment, the counsel at that level for the government stated that the only plain text which was in play for the government's argument was the word, that word, extension, sorry. Is that your position today? And is that the door through which you get to ambiguity?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is that the door through which you get to ambiguity in the wonderful world of Sutherland?
Your Honor, we would say that the title, by saying extension of the statute of limitations, shows intent by Congress to have the
have the statute of limitations apply retrospectively.
So you would say that the analysis is over at that point?
Yes, Your Honor.
You need not look beyond the plain text.
No, Your Honor. We would say that in and of itself is evidence of intent to...
But let me ask you a question. Can you extend something forward as well as backwards?
Yes, you can, Your Honor.
So is not that a point of ambiguity?
It could be considered ambiguous, Your Honor. In such, if it is...
So why is this plain text not ambiguous? Not ambiguous as to whether it is extending forward, backwards, or both?
It could be considered to be ambiguous, Your Honor.
Okay. So the door to ambiguity is now open.
Yes, Your Honor.
Enter Sutherland and others. What are we to make of these cases like the CCA relying on a Connecticut case? Decided that it would not apply what it referred to as strict construction, but instead would apply liberal construction. What do you make of the appellant's argument about Hassett, the dicta and 2C about prospective and presumptions? Because if once that door to ambiguity is open, we have to look. Now, you might quote me back Frankfurter's language about statutory interpretation, but aside from doing that, the CCA did not find any guidance in Supreme Court opinions whatsoever. There's no cite to them. What is your response to the appellant's citation to 2C and Hassett?
Your Honor, specifically talking about, first about 2C. 2C was dealing with when a petitioner failed to register for the draft. In doing so, what the court was trying to determine was whether or not it was a continuing offense.
Well, I understand that that's why I refer to dicta, because I understand that the holding is not applicable. But the Supreme Court is saying things like, for these reasons and others, we have stated before the principle that criminal limitations statutes are to be liberally interpreted in favor of repose. And that follows a discussion about statute of limitations. Dicta for sure. And in Hassett, the Supreme Court stated sort of quite nakedly that the statutes are presumed to be forward prospective in application unless there's a clear intent that they're not intended to be.
Your Honor.
Therefore, we should say that's just the Supreme Court and we should follow the Connecticut Supreme Court instead?
No, Your Honor, but I would go back to the reason why I bring up the fact that this is a continuing offense is because in those cases, specifically 2C, what it's talking about is the creation of a new offense. That is, with each new day, the offense reopens for what 2C was talking about under the...
I agree with you completely on the holding. Here again, I'm saying, if we're a court floundering about trying to figure whether in the words of the CCA, which may or may not be correct, a strict or liberal construction should be applied, and we're looking for some guidance somewhere, persuasive if not binding, and the Supreme Court in dicta has stated that the presumption is that statutes apply prospectively rather than retrospectively, how would you steer us away from that dicta and say, but wait, you must also consider this?
I would go back to the court's decision in Merriman, sir, and I don't have the quote here. The court says that in criminal law areas, such statutes represent a legislative, talking about statute of limitations, represent a legislative judgment about the balance of equities in a situation regarding the tardy assertion of otherwise valid rights. What they are talking about in Marion is this notion of what is Congress attempting to do and balancing those equities. In such, we have to look at the history of the statute of Article 43 and determine what it is that Congress was intending to do, specifically dealing with allegations of child abuse.
So your response, if I want to, this may be a lever here, on which the case revolves. Your response is, unfortunately, we're not in that case because we have clear congressional intent?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your response?
What did Congress do here? What did they do as a matter of writing a statute?
Your Honor, they attempted to extend the statute of limitations.
Did they do what Senator Nelson did in his bill?
No, they did not.
No, they did not. What did they do? Did they extend an existing statute, or did they carve out a new exception to a general statute of limitations?
They carved out an extension to...
Carved out an extension?
I apologize, Your Honor.
Okay.
They extended part of what is a general statute of limitations. That is, they took a Article 43 and put in extra language regarding child abuse cases.
Okay. They did not incorporate by reference 3283.
No, they did not.
They did not. Okay. So, in other words, you are at odds with the CCA's characterization in which they say that they did that, that they did that.
I apologize, Your Honor. They did in part, they did not incorporate as a whole the language that we find in the CCAA.
I mean, does Article 43 today contain any mention of 18 U.S.C. 3283?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. With regard to the word extension, as a normal matter of federal statutory construction, is the catch line of a statute operative statutory language?
No, Your Honor. However, it has been, and I go back to U.S. versus Armando Torres, which says that a title of a statute and heading of a section are tools available for resolution of doubt in the meaning of the statute. Mm-hmm. So we can use the title in order to understand what the legislative intent was when they drafted the statute.
Okay. Is there anything in legislative history that indicates one way or another?
Yes, Your Honor. There is actually, when we look specifically at...
In the 2003 legislature.
Yes, Your Honor. I go back to Florida Senator Bill Nelson, who introduced the bill, and I'd like to quote his language exactly. Serious convictions were overturned by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces.
Was he referring to the National Defense Authorization Act or the S-326 when he said that?
He was referring to Senate Bill 326.
Okay. Then how is that a construction of the National Defense Authorization Act?
Your Honor, it's informative of what...
Of what Senator Nelson's intent may have been, but Congress didn't incorporate Senator Nelson's language.
They did not specifically, no, Your Honor. However, by looking at that and how specific it was...
Do you have anything else in the legislative history that indicates one way or another?
Other than the title, Your Honor. I'd like to point out judicial treatment, although not specifically incorporated, the judicial treatment of the VCAA, United States versus Jeffrey, specifically refers to the use of the title extension in making this decision that the VCAA was to apply retroactively, a decision which was also upheld in United States versus Chief. Further, even if we determine that the statute itself is ambiguous, if the court determines that the legislative history is ambiguous, then we go to the fact that most courts consider the statute of limitations to be procedural in nature, and as such, find that they are not subject to the same laws of interpretation and apply them retroactively. This, as the court has referred to before, was the finding in Skakel versus Connecticut. It was also found to be true in New York versus Beretta and U.S. versus Lusk. Ohio v. Lusk. Other courts have talked about the differences.
That goes to whether you can do it. Does that necessarily inform whether Congress intended to do it?
No, Your Honor. But those cases actually talk about the assumption of the court that Congress intended for law, statutes of limitations.
But there they're going and looking at the text before them, are they not?
As part of it, yes, Your Honor. But they also talk about it as just an overall, general assumption. And
that you can, not that you did. Because there's no question you can, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I think what you're getting at And I'd like you to complete this thought. Judge Baker, did you get an answer to your question?
I can.
No, go ahead.
Is there something about something being procedural that implies that it's retroactive absent some other?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, that's what I want you to play out. Is there a presumption that procedural changes to law are retroactive?
Yes, Your Honor.
And based on A and B?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are A and B? Where do you get that presumption from?
You get the presumption from the case law itself, which talks about what the intent is in a statute of limitation, in an extension of a statute of limitation, and that is the assumption that the legislature, in extending statute of limitations, intended it to apply to all statute of limitations which are currently open.
Well, isn't the purpose of statute of limitation repose and the and getting rid of stale controversies? Doesn't that cut the other way?
It goes both. There is a purpose in trying to keep there from being stale legislation. However, in specific instances where Congress or the legislature has determined that it wishes to extend that time, that they obviously have a reason for wanting to extend it as well. For example, when we
but that doesn't necessarily go to retroactivity. Without you know, something in the statute saying so or something in the legislative history indicating so.
Your Honor, there are courts which have determined that it is just assumed immediately that when you have an extension or a statute of limitation extension, that you assume that it applies retroactively. And if I could point out an example that was before this court before, when this actually deals with the revision of the statute of limitations in 1986. And in that particular, at that time, in Article 43 regarding statute of limitations, Congress went ahead and said that they wanted to revise statute of limitations to extend, to have it apply for a longer period of time. They specifically referred to it as a revision and gave the specific wording that it needed to.
Didn't Congress in 1986 explicitly include language pushing it back?
Yeah, no, Your Honor. It specifically included language saying that it was only to operate.
Okay, it specifically included language indicating whether or not it was to be prospective.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's an explicit statement of legislative intent.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's what it, so that being understood.
That's not this case.
That's not this case, Your Honor. But what it does do is it informs how Congress intends for its statutes to be interpreted.
Counsel, what you're getting at before, very quickly, is a case in which the statute itself doesn't tell you, and the legislative history doesn't tell you. At that point, what principle do you apply to determine whether it's retroactive or prospective?
You would apply the principle, the assumption that as a procedural rule, it is, Your Honor, I apologize to say I
that. That answers my question. Thank you. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Your Honor. The government's position is this court does not have jurisdiction under Article 67C. However, the substantive issue still falls in favor of the government. Congress extended the statute of limitations in 2003 for child sexual assault, and the appellant's conduct fell within that extension. As such, he was properly charged and conviction, and this court should affirm that decision.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Subject to question, I have none.
Thank you. That the case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your arguments today, and we will reconvene at 5 minutes after 10 o'clock. Thank you.
Court stands in recess until 10:05.